Hi, I'm Arish Shah, host of the Nothing Ventured podcast. As a CFO that has operated in the startup and scale-up ecosystem for the last decade, and as a founder myself, I found it absolutely essential to learn from those that have come before me. So this podcast is an exploration of the people, the characters, the stories, and the narratives that make the venture ecosystem go round. From emerging fund managers to established VCs, from angel investors to founders, I chat to people that make the tech ecosystem thrive. Please remember to like, rate, and subscribe to the podcast because it really helps with our discoverability. And in the meantime, I hope you enjoy the pod. I'm really excited to have with me in the studio today, Andy Ayam. Andy is a father, husband, creator, thinker, investor, and founder of Angel Investing School, which is democratizing access to angel investment. In today's episodes, we talked about failure as a badge of honor. We talk about modern day angels, strong surfers on big waves, investing as education and why you need to pay to play, and vision in ink and strategy in pencil. Andy, great to have you in the studio with me.
It's a pleasure to be here. I'm looking forward to this conversation. So thanks for having me.
I think this is going to be awesome. And as we've talked about, earlier on, I think there's so much to cover. I'm excited to get into it, but I'm also nervous whether we're going to actually be able to cover everything. for the listeners, if you want to learn a little bit more about Andy's background, do check out the primer. But for now, let's dive straight in. So, you know, we've spoken previously about the kind of barriers perceived mm-hmm. or actual to people building an angel investing investment portfolio. From your perspective, what is it that really holds people back, right? What is that mindset sort of issue that a lot of people have, and how does the Angel Investing School help break down those barriers?
So let's do a quick exercise with our listeners, because if you close your eyes for a second and you imagine to yourself a retired middle-class man on a golf course somewhere with his friend, and they're really wealthy, and they're probably white and middle-class, right? And this is your typical picture of what an angel investor is. Someone that's super wealthy, super rich, can afford a lavish life and can afford to invest into startups. And actually, when we talk about the modern day angel investor, it's very far from that. That's someone that could do angel invest, but so can you. And the key thing that we talk about here is the mindset of starting where you are. Okay, the way that technology has advanced means that we've democratized access to angel investing. We now have equity crowdfunding platforms where you can invest as little as a few hundred pounds into brands that you love. The gap there is the education gap, which is what the Angel Investing School is filling by educating people on making informed decisions on the risk that they're taking when investing into startups, so you don't afford more than you can afford to lose. Mm-hmm. Okay, the second barrier that often exists is, how useful can I be to an entrepreneur, right? And, you know, there's so many ways that you can be useful with the little things that you probably overlook, from helping them with hiring by just, you know, amplifying a job post on LinkedIn, to introducing them to customers or suppliers or partners that could be for their company. Did you know that you could introduce a startup to a customer and it's an enterprise client who can, you know, pay up to $500,000 in contract revenue for a year? And that is a lot more valuable than giving away equity in your business and diluting yourself and giving away ownership in this baby that you're building. So I'd much rather have an introduction to a customer that can give me revenue than to give away equity to get that same money, right? That person could also lean onto their superpower. I've worked in marketing for 20 years in the FMCG sector, so I can really help with your food brand because I know what I'm doing. Right, so these are all the little ways that we can be helpful, and I think these are the things that you need to lean into when you're actually getting started on the journey of angel investing. And a lot of that is more about mindset rather than money. And the final way that we are really helpful in the Angel Investing School, and I think what differentiates us, is we meet you where you are. We break down the jargon and we speak plain English. Finance is notorious for this, having three-letter acronyms and having so much jargon to confuse people. On your credit card, you have 90% APR. What's APR even stand for? How do I calculate APR? So how much do I pay a month? This is the finance industry. So what we're really good at doing is breaking down exactly what things mean in plain English so that the everyday person understands it and it's demystified. And before you know it, you realize actually it's not as complex as it sounds on the surface. It could be really simple once you have the right person guiding and supporting you.
I think it's super interesting. I was just laughing to myself because as a CFO, like I'm probably fairly guilty of having used a lot of that jargon myself. But this is reality. Like, you know, finance Absolutely. Often feels like a foreign language, but actually, you know, a safe note, for example, a simple agreement for future equity is exactly what it says it
Absolutely.
Is. But when you hear Great safe, example. If you don't know what it is, like you're like, oh, that feels like a really difficult legal document to get my head around. But actually, all you're saying is give me some money today and I'll give you some equity tomorrow, right? And that should be simple enough for everyone to understand. But the other thing that I think that comes out of everything you just said is there's also this kind of mindset differentiation is one that I struggle with actually quite a lot between what it means to be an angel investor versus what it means to be a VC investor. And, and the reason I say that is I spend so much time in the venture ecosystem talking to people, working with clients that we have that have been venture-backed and so on, that I look at a lot of kind of investing through the lens of venture, which is always looking for outsized outcomes, right? Whereas with angel investing, you're not necessarily looking for that 100x outcome or, you know, returning, you know, 500 times your investment or whatever it might be. Actually, a lot of angel investments are much more ongoing. They may be for kind of dividend flow in the future. They may be much more kind of what one would call traditional, maybe lifestyle businesses. They don't need to have those massive, massive outcomes. How would you kind of describe that difference between angel and VCs from a mindset perspective?
If we take a company that everyone knows, like a Coca-Cola, publicly listed company, once you're publicly listed and you're actually floating on a stock exchange, you are there to serve shareholder value. So every quarter, you're reporting on the growth of the business and the profits in the business because that's what your shareholders want. When you start a VC fund, you're actually a fund manager. You're employed to manage money on behalf of other institutions. It could be a pension fund that's putting money into your VC fund. It could be an endowment fund. It could be a family office, which is a company that's been set up to manage the wealth of a wealthy individual family.
Even the term family office, so many people don't actually understand what that is, because it is actually not the family. It is the business, exactly as you said, that has been set up to manage that capital.
To create wealth. So, you know, someone famous like Will Smith has a family office who manages his wealth and invests into a number of different asset classes. So that VC firm, as a money management institution, has taken on this capital in the promise to try and make a return to those investors. So if I raise a £500 million fund, right, it's a big fund, but we have investment funds in the UK like Atomico, we've raised £800 million, for example, or Index Ventures or Local Globe or some of our tier one funds, which are the premier funds, I guess, in Europe. Once I do that, it drives my strategy for what I can then invest in. Because then what I'm really trying to do is invest in what we call the top 5% of companies a year that are most likely to return my money. Because when a VC fund invests, and let's say they invest even $1 million or $3 million into your round, they may have 3% equity after each round of funding and they get diluted down. So at the end, if you do achieve an exit or an outcome such as being acquired, you need to be acquired at, let's say, a $4 billion valuation or more for them to be able to return that 3x their fund.
Yeah.
That's a really big outcome.
It's a pretty high bar.
So you as a startup needs to understand that if I'm taking capital from this VC who's raised a £100 million fund, who needs a $4 billion exit, that's going to dictate the strategy that I need to pursue now in order to return money to that venture capital organization.
Yeah.
So a lot of pressure comes with that because you inherit a strategy.
It's the fund strategy rather than your own.
It's the fund strategy, not your own.
Yeah.
But that's not necessarily wrong if that matches up with your ambitions. If you truly believe that you're building a globally important company that's going to be a category winner, to say that, okay, I'm going to compete with Uber and Lyft and I'm going to be number one and number two in that category, therefore I can return the funds. If that truly aligns with what you want to do, then absolutely go for it. We talk about this concept of strong surfers on big tides, right? Like when there's a big wave, it's going to attract the strongest surfers. But which one can you identify is going to be the surfer that can ride that wave the longest? It's a really hard thing to do. There's a lot of luck involved in that as well. A lot of that is outside of your control as an investor because you're not the management team and you're not influencing the investment in that way. That's where private equity as an organization is very different, because often private equity is putting in a management team to de-risk their investment and to improve the likelihood that they can make their money back. It's a very different vehicle to venture capital. And actually, they have a higher success rate because of that. So in venture capital, often you'd hear about a third, a third, a third, because a third of your portfolio is going to fail to make a return. Mm-hmm. A third of your portfolio will make 1x, which is not the return that I want. And a third of your portfolio are the most likely to make your venture-like returns. Mm. And actually, when you go into that last third, it's usually two or three companies that dominate the returns and allow you to make the losses on the rest of your portfolio. Now, if you're in the rest of that portfolio for a VC, how much love and attention are you getting and support? So I'm on certain cap tables now, which means that I've invested into a company. I'm on their register or their list of people that have invested, aka a cap table. And I'm probably one of the most helpful investors, even though I'm one of the most smallest investors on that cap table. Why? Because when that startup sends every month an investor update email, I'm responding to that email and making introductions or helping them with that tactical issue that they're facing. And that is the strength of having someone like an angel investor on board, because I haven't got a portfolio of 200 startups or 150 startups. So I can give love and attention to the 12 startups that I've invested in. Whereas once you invest in a portfolio like a VC does, they're more tactical on who they can support and why. And I'm not saying every VC is the same and cut from the same cloth, but you will find that once you get into that game. So it's really important to understand the rules of engagement before going down that path. Now, when we look at an angel investor, some of the differences is that I'm investing my own money rather than another institution's money. Therefore, I can do whatever I want with my own money. But the downside is it's really hard to find me because it's fragmented. I haven't necessarily got a website saying, hey, I'm Andy AM. I'm an angel investor. I've got $1 million to invest this year. That's what a VC does, because they need to market to you because they're in the business of doing that. Whereas as an angel investor, I could be buying a family home this year, and I could be buying a new car this year, and I could be investing my own business. So you have no clue if I'm in or out of the money. So it makes it really difficult to first start and having relationships with these angels, but then to maintain relationships and understand who's in and out of the money, who can seriously invest right now and who can't. And that what makes that market really inefficient and difficult for a founder. The other thing with an angel investor that's really important to understand is, because they're building a portfolio often from scratch, or they're a small-time ticket investor, actually you need to leverage vehicles and platforms such as Odin and Valbon to allow people to basically collectively invest small amounts of money that hopefully aggregate to a meaningful sum. So even though I might invest 2 or 5,000, I might bring other investors in, like I did with Ava Estelle last year as an example, and we invested around 150,000 collectively together. That is meaningful for that startup. And actually it's really efficient, because they can manage one relationship with me and I've managed these 10 relationships to bring others into that cap table.
I mean, you know, just as an aside, I think I mentioned it on another podcast recently, I'm an investor in Odin in their last round with a very small check, and one of 200 investors, because they use their own product to wrap everyone up onto one line on their cap table. And it is an incredible way to get involved. Absolutely. In really, really interesting and potentially, you know, game-changing businesses at a very small level. So that, to your point, that barrier to entry has decreased massively. The overhead has decreased massively.
Absolutely.
And your access now to a wide variety of deals has improved dramatically.
And can we double click on that? And I hate using that term, but can we double click on access? Because I think what some people need to realize is, when we've gone through this education system from primary school to secondary school to college to university, we're paying to play. We go to university, we pay, and we learn. When you start the world of work, you're getting paid to learn.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very different shift. So then if I choose that I want to go on an MBA program, I'm paying £15,000 to £20,000 at least to go on that program. Now, if I said to myself, instead of going on an MBA program, I'm going to create this budget of $20,000, and I want to learn about new technologies like NFT and blockchain, but I also want to learn about business building and entrepreneurship, and I also want to learn about how to build high-impact teams, I could angel invest to learn those skills. It's paying to play in a different way for your education. And this is why I talk about reframing your mindset around the cost of what you learn. And at a minimum, with an angel investment, even though you may not make a financial return, you actually make a return in terms of what you learn and the relationships that you build. So if I go to an MBA and I get, you know, all of these relationships, and I can get into these industries, and I can actually gain that from angel investing too. I can form a really meaningful network. I can get into new industries, and I can learn about new technologies and business building in a really practical, hands-on way. And I think that's a really useful way for people to suddenly reframe this opportunity of paying to play.
I think I could wax lyrical about education because I think it's massively broken. I think it does not set up our youth for success in today's environment. I mean, it's a 150 years old system that is not really fit for purpose.
I would argue actually our cities are built in the same way. They were built around industrialization and professionals and going to work. And then we've had COVID. What's going to happen to cities? No longer need to live near central London. I'm working from home all the time.
Yeah.
So how do we redesign cities even for tomorrow? These are the problems that entrepreneurs solve that are really interesting that we're backing and getting involved in.
And this is the thing. Entrepreneurs think about this stuff deeply. And I think the thing that's really interesting for me, again, is there are several ways. Like, I love the you know, you said in the primer episode, failure is a badge of honor, right? And that's the way people think about it in kind of Silicon Valley and the US. Whereas in the UK, we still have a little bit of... Yeah. You know, that negativity and, you know, those issues around failure, like we don't like failure, right? And in fact, a lot of the press in the UK at the moment, right, if you think about how the Future Fund has been reported, right, the Future Fund was set up by Rishi Sunak and British Business Bank and the Treasury during COVID to support early stage businesses. All of the press has been like, look at all of these ones that have failed. But actually, that is kind of normal in the venture and startup ecosystem. Absolutely. And in fact, is a great way for employees of those businesses and founders of the businesses to learn and hopefully relaunch and take their learnings and build back better and stronger in the future. And I think, you know, reframing that whole idea of like, okay, if an MBA is going to cost me 20 to 50 grand, actually I could learn just as much and actually really learn just by putting that money to work in a different way. I think it's actually something that I'd certainly not thought about at all.
You know what I love about what you're touching on as well is that it takes an ecosystem to succeed. In Africa, we have a proverb that it takes a village to raise a child. And the same is true because you've got academic institutions that breed great talent for like machine learning and engineering. But you also got government institutions, which are really important for progressive policy and create incentives for entrepreneurship, like the SEIS and EIS schemes, which give tax incentives in the UK for investors into startups. But then you've also got incubators and accelerators where people have a safe space to play and test ideas and try things out and learn how to start a startup in a cost-effective way. But then you've also got communities so people feel less lonely, whether it's for female founders or for black founders or for founders in fintech or in hardware.
Well, let's touch on that for a second, right? Because you and I have had a very, very brief conversation about this. Like, there are a lot, and I mean a lot of communities out there, right? Like, I think I've got a dozen WhatsApp kind of communities, another several Slack ones. A lot of them are doing very similar things in very, very similar sort of spaces or targeted very similar kind of cohorts. Do you think they're doing enough to actually grow collectively as a community, or is it just a bit too fragmented now?
I think what some of these communities really lack is real clarity on their vision. Mm-hmm. You know, I always talk about writing your vision in ink and your strategy in pencil, which means that you've got to be willing to meander and change your strategy in order to achieve your vision. We're seeing a lot of that right now in the current market conditions where actually capital is less available and people are going to have to survive on cash flows for a lot longer. And the reason that I say that is because if my goal is to move the needle on, let's say, less than 0.2%, let's call it 0% if we're rounding error, right? If 0% of venture capital goes to black female founders, and my goal is to get that to 2%, I should, in theory, be able to collaborate with anyone else whose mission aligned with moving that needle from 0 to 2%. Mm. And if there's a barrier towards us collaborating, what is that? Is that the values? Is that ego? Because I want to be an entrepreneur and I want to be my own boss and I want to be the person known for doing this thing. Is that because actually we're seeing things through a slightly different lens from each other? And these are the barriers that we should address, because collectively we have more power. We have more lobbying power for government. We have more power in terms of working with venture capitalists and change that systemic issue. We have more power in how we think about the problem solving. And one thing that I talk a lot about when I'm talking to young people thinking about careers in venture is we need people in venture, but we also need people who are going to be employees. We can't have everyone being entrepreneurs. We need people rising in those different spaces. Because right now, one of the problems that I'm really thinking about is, who are the CMOs that I know in my network? Who are the CFOs I know in my network? How diverse are they? Because now I'm hiring for talent at a later stage for a lot of these startups or companies that are getting acquired. Actually, how diverse is the talent pool that I'm trying to hire from. And it's a real challenge for me because everyone suddenly wants to be an entrepreneur. And every entrepreneur that succeeds at scale needs to build a team. But it's almost like if they divorce that fact from their mindset to think I'm an entrepreneur instead of actually what I'm doing is building a high performance team to really scale my impact and achieve this impact on a global scale. And we're all going to have to hire teams to be able to do that.
I was again giggling when you said, just because so much of this stuff resonates. When I was working with EatonX, which was a joint venture, like if you want to talk about privilege, it was a joint venture between Eton College and Founders Factory. It was selling kind of leadership and soft skills training to Chinese high school students in China. And anecdotally, when our team was out there and they were giving a session to some Chinese students in one of the schools, one of the kids got up and he literally said, but if everyone's going to be a leader, who's going to be the labor?
Right.
And I think that like it touches on this really important thing. Like for the last several years, I've talked a lot about, you know, the values of being your own boss, like the benefits that come out of that. But then equally over time, I've also realized that not everyone is cut out to be the boss, right? Not everyone can be a leader. Not everyone can be an entrepreneur. There is risk. There are other, you know, there are other issues in your own personal life that may, you know, stop you from doing that. And to your point, actually, you need to have the people around you because, you know, as an investor, the first thing you look at is who is this team and can they execute? So you need those people to be able to build with you. So let's shift kind of gear for a second, actually, and talk just about that. Like, what does it mean to build a startup in 2023? What is lean? What is a lean startup for 2023? Because things have changed quite dramatically.
I think what's really important when we talk about a lean startup or how to build a startup, we can't lean on references from the US and San Francisco and Y Combinator. Because context matters. And that's why I can't give you a generic solution because the context matters. The fact that I grew up, let's say, as a Pakistani boy in a working class community in London really matters. Because now what I'm going to look for in that person is, actually, what is your lived experience? Forget just your job titles. Oh, wait a second. So if you've worked for the last 15 years in the drinks and manufacturing industry and you've been on the supply chain side of things, so you really know how manufacturing works, you've noticed some inefficiencies. Right, that makes you really well suited, given your origin story, to solve this particular problem with supply chain and manufacturing within the FMCG industry. It was really important for me to know your lived experience and what you've done in the past in your context to know why you're well suited for that problem. It's also really well suited because it might tell me that actually cost efficiency is front of mind for you because growing up for you was about survival and not an adventure. So you never had a financial safety net. So actually you've always been resourceful. So you understand cost efficiency like a second language. That's really important to know because in this market, it's really hard to raise cash. So cost efficiency and resourcefulness is a superpower. That's really important to know. So now that I know that, actually, what else do I need to know? How you build teams? Oh, wait, so two of your former colleagues that you used to work with want to follow you on this journey. Huh, that's interesting. That shows me that you inspire followership. If you inspire followership, that means that rather than taking this high-paid job at a really big company like Diageo in our industry, I'm choosing to forego that to follow you because you're such a pleasure to work with. That's another positive signal. So now that you're building this team that's high-performing who you've worked with before, how are you going to go about building your business? Are you going to go away in a dark room for 9 months and build in isolation? Or are you going to build with customers and validate things early and often? Are you going to think about how can I build something small, cheap, and quickly so I can validate my learnings and see if I'm taking a step in the right direction? Oh, that's really interesting. So you partnered with these other firms that you know really well to really just do an MVP to prove demand for this thing that you want to build. Oh, that's interesting. Then you did a joint venture next with just one single firm, and they've got actually units within Germany, France and the UK, and now you're doing fulfillment in those three countries. Interesting. Oh, and now that you've brought engineering, you've built software on top to build more efficiencies into the building business, and actually that's a more native way for your customers who are a lot younger to actually operate. Interesting. And suddenly you see them step by step building and iterating in public. And that whole route that I've just described is actually what the lean startup looks like with cultural context of a working class entrepreneur.
Mm. that's a lot to digest. And the reason I say that is because I was like, halfway through, I was like, okay, that could half be me. I mean, like, I've sort of semi-worked in manufacturing for sure.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, like, I lived 10 years in Papua New Guinea running manufacturing businesses.
Wow.
And believe you me, if you can figure out how cash flow works in those environments, you can figure out
it's
how a SaaS.
Complex,
you,
yeah.
You figure out how a SaaS business works for sure. And I think the interesting thing there, though, that comes out is, not all nation businesses are technology businesses, right?
Absolutely.
Like, yes, we know that technology has the power and the opportunity to change, by orders of magnitude, but you still need bricks and mortar businesses to do
Absolutely.
Stuff. And there is still massive, massive change that can be affected even in traditional businesses, I think, number one. The second thing is, you know, I've talked a lot on this podcast about how do we democratize access to entrepreneurship, right? So I think one of the massive kind of privileges that I've had, I grew up in privilege, right? I come from an East African Indian family and went to private schools, went to university, like very objectively a privileged kind of upbringing. But there are people that, you know, if they set up a business today, right? And
yeah.
they put their cash into it. If they couldn't pay their rent tomorrow, they could not go back and live with their parents for
right.
6 months and sort themselves out. I'm very privileged that I can do that, right?
Yeah.
And indeed did do that when I came back from New Guinea, stayed with my parents for 3 or 4 months with the family before we found a place to stay, et cetera, right? Equally, most people don't have the cash to start a business, right?
Yeah.
Like, it is a leap of faith. It is a massive leap of faith. Whether you're capital efficient or not, like just simply having the will and the resilience and the self, I guess, belief that you can actually launch a business is a massive, massive challenge, but opportunity, I think, in the current market, to your point as well, right? And let's talk about this sort of bootstrapping and cash efficiency, right?
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you. I think people from migrant backgrounds, often from third country backgrounds, often do have a very, very frugal mentality, right? Like,
yeah.
you know, we were certainly I was raised as an Indian,
yeah.
Earn a pound, spend 99p, you'll be happy. I'm not sure if I've ever lived up quite to that ethos, but like that is the way that certainly my father would have counseled me in the past. And in today's environment, you said, right, like it's very hard to raise capital. And that is because of a number of factors, but mainly because we had a lot of hubris over the last few years and things have come back to kind of a normal state, right? This is not, it is not that things will now get back to where they were.
No.
This is actually what things should have been. So now bootstrapping and capital efficient businesses are becoming really important, especially for angel investors, I would say, more than VCs.
Yeah.
Because VCs, when they see a bootstrap business, like ultimately, when you take VC funding, it is to do the opposite of what you would do if you're bootstrapping.
Mm.
Because taking VC funding is all about
hyper growth,
taking massive bets and
yep.
seeing whether they pay off. And those massive bets can either lead to massive success or massive failure. Whereas
yep.
bootstrapping, you may not see massive success, but you probably won't see massive
yeah.
failure. But
yeah.
why, in your opinion, is it so important now, this whole kind
of
mentality?
Before I get deeper into bootstrapping, I think when we talk about outcomes, I didn't touch on this earlier, but for an angel investor and founder, a founder could be in a situation where, you know, and this could happen with some of my portfolio companies in the next couple of years. There's an opportunity to exit and they could sell the business for 160 million. Life-changing money for the founder.
Mm-hmm.
Great exit for the angel. Terrible result for the VC that's raised a £100 million fund.
Yeah.
So if you had a VC investor who had invested, they may be telling the founder that you're more ambitious. You should carry on building. There's so much more opportunity for you to grab. The angel investor could be telling you, you know, you've worked hard and sacrificed so much of your life over the last 5 years. You deserve a good exit from this business. Take a break and you can think about doing something in the future. But you're in a financial position to change you and your family's life.
Yeah.
Both are trying to tell the truth from their perspectives.
Yeah. yeah.
And that founder then has the decision themselves to do what's right for them.
Yeah.
And only they're going to know if they are more ambitious and they want to do more and there's more fuel in the tank, or if there's time to step away from it and take successes, and both can lead to success. But if you carry on down that route, it can also lead to failure as well. So again, it comes down to your ambitions, but also risk and actually your family. because wealth at that level impacts you and your family and those around you and your early employees. So it's not just a selfish decision that you can take in isolation. Now, when we talk about bootstrapping, there's certain types of business models that are important to understand. So there's consultancy and agency business models, very lean to start off with. You can literally start as a freelancer or consultant yourself. Mm-hmm. Build enough relationships that you win enough work that you start hiring others to start doing work. Suddenly you've built a consultancy practice or an agency. You don't need much capital up front to start that business.
Yep, done it myself and like very, very simple.
Exactly. Yeah. Then you have other businesses such as I look at Plant Made. It's a great example. Haven't taken any outside capital. I even wanted to invest myself and they didn't take any capital, right? And Emma's done a fantastic job in saving her wage for, let's say, 6 to 8 months to provide her with her initial runway to get stock, start selling, start making a profit, saving that profit and reinvesting in the business. Mm. And now it's a 7-figure business. Mm. It's a very patient journey and we call that patient capital. But actually, she's much more resilient in this market conditions, especially because she's solving a problem that's recession proof. If I've got issues with my hair or my skin, it's not the recession that makes a difference. I need to still buy my creams. I need to still buy my shampoos.
Yep.
And I think that's really important to understand about products and resilience in certain markets. You need to understand, like, how does customer behavior change and what doesn't change and stay true? Mm-hmm. Am I still taking a shower and brushing my teeth every day regardless of the market conditions? Hell yeah, I am. And that's not going to change regardless of how the market moves. And those kind of products are really resilient in this market. So it's about understanding the business model and the type of business that you're starting and actually whether you can take that lean approach. And I think with software, what's important to understand is it's really difficult to be lean unless you have software development skills.
Yourself, yeah.
Unless I can build that software myself, I'm going to have to outsource it, which has a number of red flags. Mm-hmm. Or I'm going to have to hire developers, which is really expensive. So therefore, I may change my decision to say, actually, what can I do without building software? And that might change my business model and my approach to solving a problem.
Although one thing I would add is obviously with kind of the explosion of generative AI and ChatGPT, you can now literally get the AI to build your software for you. So you can, if you
I'll
do
tell you
need
the problem,
to.
You, yeah, I'll tell you on. The problem with that. Go the on. Problem with that is it becomes really difficult to iterate on something you don't
Correct.
Understand.
Exactly, yeah.
So when we talk about that use case, that customers still talking about this problem they solve, it's really difficult for me to then change my software to solve that problem because I don't even understand how the software works.
Yeah.
Or we talk about external APIs to integrate with the third party. Suddenly I'm reaching the limits and the bounds of what AI can achieve for me today. Not to say that it can't achieve that tomorrow.
Mm. But what it can do, I guess, is get you off the ground, right?
Yes.
And then to like,
and maybe you get enough revenues to start building that team.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. Or at least a proof point where maybe you can go out and either raise capital or figure out a way of doing
and
something.
And no-code tools have been popularized 100%. For doing that very thing.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I mean, I think, you know, as someone who has been both a bootstrap founder, an angel invested founder, and then have moved back to bootstrapped on that business, like the other thing that I think is super important for founders to understand is like what sort of a person and personality are they? Are they the sort of person that wants to be beholden to investors? Because I think someone said this to me, you know, a couple of years ago, the minute you take investment, you are guaranteeing an exit of some nature to your investors. And that exit might be you close a business. It may be that you sell the business. It may be the IPO, whatever it might be, right? But you are essentially guaranteeing them some form of kind of
Yes, you're not passing
event.
That down to your children.
Correct,
That's
right?
off the table now.
There is something that is going to happen, right? I, as an example, am actually the sort of person that does not enjoy having, like, I'm a bit anti-authoritarian. I don't love having investors on my cap table and having to report back to them. I like to be able to do what I want to do. And I think this is the other thing. I think a lot of founders probably they underestimate the cognitive and administrative and mental overhead that comes with taking on investors. Mm. Because you are no longer just building for yourself. You are building for other people, right?
And by the way, I think if you're a founder who's not sure, you can still build an advisory board as
correct.
A way to start building that stakeholder management skill set, feel a feeling of what it's like to have accountability, a good step before considering like what's
taking investment or
precisely.
Yeah, yeah. I think there are a huge number of considerations that every founder has to take. And this is the problem. Like, it depends, is exactly as you said, on your background, on the industry you're building in, whether you have the ability to start bootstrapping, whether you can save that capital initially, right? In your example, you know, she was able to save 6 months' salary. that isn't necessarily the case for everyone. Some people go out, take out like Virgin Startup Loan, which is kind of a government incentivized Absolutely. Loan. But again, you've got to repay that loan, right? Yeah. Like, okay, it's terms are favorable, but it's still a loan, right? You're still got to be able to pay it back. And I think, you know, the amazing thing about entrepreneurship is that you do learn a lot. But often that learning comes with a cost, to your point. You pay to play, right? And part of that cost is learning how to manage people, investors. It is how to manage your cash. It is how to manage your business and your employees and so on and so forth. And, you know, there's been a couple of stories in the press recently. I think TechEU reported, I can't remember the name of the startup, but it was a Spanish startup, hasn't paid his employees since September of last year, ran out of cash, obviously wasn't able to raise again. Those are the stories that I think are really damaging to the ecosystem, because those things should not happen, right? Mm. But
can I say something about the stories? Because I think the stories we tell ourselves and the narratives we tell ourselves are super important.
Mm.
And venture capital, and I want to say this to demystify it for people, venture capital doesn't just go to the best founders and best ideas.
Mm-hmm.
It goes to some terrible founders and terrible ideas. And we've seen that in the press with FTX.
Yep.
How did that happen?
50-minute grocery.
Yeah. Or is it JP Morgan with Frank?
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Mm.
Like, it's because it chases terrible deals as well. Mm-hmm. So you cannot then, as a founder, say to yourself, like, I'm not worthy or my idea is not good because I can't raise. You need to divorce the two. And I think that identity crisis sometimes exists for founders. Like, I didn't raise. They don't know what they're doing. I'm a great founder, or I'm not great because they didn't invest. That's garbage.
They've got to remember the venture is the means, not the end.
Like, absolutely.
It is the fuel. It isn't the fire itself.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. We're gonna close off with a bit of a deeper question, right? So you spent, as we discussed in the primer, some time at Backstage Capital, leading their accelerator here in London. Arlen Hamilton is a force of nature. I mean, certainly on Twitter, she was up until I think Elon acquired it, pretty active. But she is a force of nature when it comes to talking about the need for more diversity in the ecosystem. And when Backstage slowed down and downsized dramatically last year, I think it was sort of mid-2022, it got a lot of backlash, right? Like, there was a lot of negativity around that. But Arlen pointed out, you know, or pointed to systemic issues, right, that were partly at play within the venture ecosystem. But where do you see the structural issues that lead to fewer diverse founders being backed and fewer diverse fund managers raising funds and so on? And the million-dollar question is, like, how do we bring about change?
Yeah, I think when we think about where wealth resides, is actually in that limited partner layer. We talk about the pension funds and the family offices. And if we don't have representative people at that table, women, people of color, then sadly we don't have people in decision-making roles that are going to actually make decisions favorably for people that they really empathize with and connect with. So it starts all the way at the top in terms of who's investing in those VC funds, because they can influence the mandate. They can influence how that VC fund should invest, because they can vote with their feet with the money that they're putting into their fund. Then we trickle down to the societal level. There's certain barriers to entry, such as, you know, they're meant to be protections, but in America, you've got the Securities Exchange Commission that says that you have to earn at least
100,000, whatever it is, or have a million in assets.
Yeah, well, in America, it's 200 million, 200,000 income,
yeah.
Or a million or more in assets, which is a barrier to entry. On the one hand, it's a protection. Yes, great. But on the other hand, we could be smarter, like we are with properties, to say, actually, you can only put 5% of your income at risk when investing into startups. And that protection keeps, again, certain people out of playing. So I could be someone that's earning like $150,000 a year. I can afford to put in $10,000 a year into startups. I don't even have the option to do that.
Mm.
In the UK, there's a bit more flexibility with our rules, because you can earn $100,000 a year or be part of an angel group for 6 months or more,
mm-hmm.
and be eligible to invest. Look, I'm not going to say this, but I haven't seen auditors or policing of these, but it's really important to have some protections in place.
Yeah.
But they do serve as barriers as well. The third thing I'll say is that for some reason, society and the media always, when it's treating black people or people of color or women as the one example that represents them all,
mm-hmm.
or Elizabeth Holmes at Theranos and that's all women. No, it's not. Or Arlen Hamilton at Backstage and that's all black people. No, it's not. Sometimes the weight of the world is on the shoulders of these founders, which is unjust and unfair. Mm-hmm. We don't say with the FTX founder, oh, he represents all white middle class men, therefore we can't invest in them. And we've got this stupid thing in the media that we do when we're talking about diversity to say, if that one is the example, therefore no one else can get it because there's what's happened to that
and,
one
and
over
just
there.
To add to that, like in the current environment where you've had a lot of fund managers come up over the last several years, you know, during the kind of plentiful times, and a lot of those emerging managers have been, you know, from diverse backgrounds. There is exactly as you say, that weight of the world is on their shoulders because, absolutely, like, if they fail, they failed for everyone. Yes. Or that is the, the message that is going to be spread.
And even with these emerging fund managers, the reason it's so hard to become an emerging fund manager, because part of the criteria is that you've worked in venture capital before, you've worked with the fund manager that you're coming to raise the fund with, and you've got a track record of investments. This is that chicken and egg. If you're not going to even allow me to be a venture capitalist and to be a general partner, you know, or enable me to be so, to do so, how the hell am I going to build that track record that you need? You know, and the British Business Bank, which is the biggest investor in the UK with emerging fund managers, requires like those barriers to be met, those criteria to be met. So we're losing a bit of the risk element of venture capital, where it's meant to be risky and investing in outlier opportunities, giving people on the outskirts of opportunity to realize opportunities that we can't see today. So we need a little bit of that capital from institutions that are influential, like the BBB, to be going to first-time emerging fund managers, to give it as experimentation money, like to give them 1 or 2 million and a 10 million fund. It's actually quite small when we're talking about 100 million pound funds.
Whereas I think that the minimum that they'll put in is 20 million or 25
precisely.
Million.
Precisely.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
Precisely.
And I mean, like these structural issues, I think, you know, over our lifetimes, certainly our lifetime, like I think, you know, a lot of work will go to trying to resolve them. Whether or not they'll be resolved is another matter. I think your point around, you know, that kind of starting at the top, it's something that I've always said, and I think I've said it many times, probably to the point of boredom on the podcast. It is all about having diverse LPs, funding diverse GPs, funding diverse founders who are building diverse teams, having meaningful exits, and then being able to recycle that capital through the ecosystem.
And when we talk about why is this important? At the fundamental human level, we need a representative number of people in decision-making decisions, shaping technology, building the future of the world for all of us. And if we don't have people in places of power and influence that represent us, then there's portions of society that are now excluded and not thought about when we're designing these products to serve society, which is my biggest risk with AI right now. If we don't have diverse inputs in terms of programming this AI, who is it really going to serve in society at scale? And for that reason, I believe products like ChatGPT should be saying, actually, limit Andy and Arash's prompts to maybe 10 a week or 10 a month, because we have enough from people from their backgrounds, theoretically. But actually, that lady in the Philippines, let her have unlimited queries, because we need to learn more from people like that.
Yeah.
That is a smart things we could do, friction in products intentionally, to drive the right inputs, to drive the representation that we need, instead of always thinking commercially first around just making money in hyperscale and growing at all costs. No, actually, the cost is to humanity. And we need to start realizing that cost before it really impacts our children and our next generation.
Andy, I think that's a lovely place to to halt the conversation for today. Certainly for today. I think there'll be plenty more to come tomorrow and beyond. But it's been absolutely incredible talking to you today. For our listeners, where's the best place for them to find you online? Are you on LinkedIn, Twitter? Where's the best place for them to
Look definitely for LinkedIn. I share a lot of knowledge for free and a lot of education and inspiration on LinkedIn. So Andy Ayim, feel free to follow me there. Turn on your notification bells. Or you can head over to andyayim.com to subscribe to my newsletter, learn all of what I do. And of course, the angelinvestingschool.com to learn more about the course. We're going to have a free code as well to get 10% off our upcoming September cohort. Probably be something like Nothing Venture 10, but we could put it in the show
notes.
Amazing.
We'll put it in the show notes for sure. Andy, thank you so much for joining me. It's been absolutely my pleasure.
The pleasure's mine. We could have gone for another hour.
I'm sure we could have.